Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to News Hour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. When Israel announced on Thursday that it had killed the leader of Hamas, Yahya Sinwar, there was much talk in Western capitals of a possible turning point in the Gaza conflict, a possible path to peace, in the words of President Biden, for the Israeli hostages still being held in Gaza, and for the humanitarian plight of Gazans. And those sentiments have been repeated today. But in confirming his death, Hamas, deemed a terror organisation by many Western governments, has quite literally stuck to its guns. The group's deputy leader, Khalil al-Haya, is currently based in Qatar.
The martyrdom of our brother Yahya Sinwar and all the commanders of our movement who preceded him will only boost our movement and our resistance, giving us power and steadfastness to continue in their path. We will be loyal to their blood and their sacrifice. We Palestinian people, we tell those who are crying over the prisoners of the occupation, these captives will not return until the aggression against our people in Gaza ends. The total withdrawal from Gaza and the release of all our heroes held in the jails of the occupation.
The words of Khalil al-Haya, the deputy leader of Hamas. But could the way forward in talks to end the conflict and secure the release of the hostages lie in whoever Hamas decides will succeed Yahya Sinwar? I've been speaking to Makaima Abusada, a visiting scholar at Northwestern University in Chicago and formerly professor of political science at Al-Azhar University in Gaza. What names, I asked him, are in contention to be the next leader of Hamas?
Hamas is a movement with a number of institutions, the Shura Council, the Political Bureau, and other smaller or lower institutions. And usually competition for the chairman of Hamas is done through their institutions, mainly the Shura Council. I believe according to their internal laws, the deputy of Yahya Sinwar is supposedly the person who will fill the vacuum, which is Khalil al-Haya. He has been his deputy since 2017, and he has been based in Qatar for a few years now. So I believe that Khalil al-Haya will probably be the most possible person to succeed Yahya Sinwar. But again, there probably might be other options.
Another name that has been mentioned is that of Khalid Mashal and also Yahya Sinwar's brother.
That is truly yes, but in two different ways. Mohammed Sinwar, who is the brother of Yahya Sinwar, will probably be leading the military wing of Hamas, Al-Qassam Brigades, but he is not a member of any political institution to be named for the chairman of Hamas. With regard to Khalid Mashal, yes, he is another possible name to be the chairman of Hamas in the next few I guess, years. But Khaled Mishal was chairman of Hamas between 1996 and all the way until 2017. So he already served his term as chairman of Hamas, and now he is serving as Hamas chairman in the so-called political bureau of the Hamas diaspora. But I think Khalil Al-Hayya might have a better chance of replacing Yahya Sinwar as a chairman of Hamas political bureau.
Let's assume that it is Khalil Al-Hayya. And how might he approach any future negotiations with the Israelis? I've seen reports that he is somebody who Washington would probably welcome.
He has been known for dealing with regard to the so-called internal Palestinian reconciliation. He just met with the Fatah deputy for reconciliation in Cairo just a few days ago. But from what I know, I have met Khalil Hayya many times. He is also a tough person. He is a hawkish person. He is not considered a moderate within Hamas. But I think when it comes to reaching a ceasefire and prisoners deal, probably Israel will have to talk to Mohammed Sinwar. He is the one who is in Gaza. He probably is the one who has the leverage over Israeli hostages in Gaza. Now, that doesn't mean Khalil Hayya doesn't have his contacts, but I think at the end of the day, whoever is in control of Gaza will decide whether there will be a prisoner exchange deal and a ceasefire or not.
But Khalil Al-Hayya has been, has he not, the lead negotiator in ceasefire discussions?
He was, after the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh at the end of July of this year, because Yahya Sinwar was in Gaza and he very much could not communicate in a very good way with the outside Hamas leadership and also the interlocutors, Egypt, Qatar, and indirectly the U.S. Yes, it was Khalil Hayya who has been dealing with the ceasefire and with the prisoners deal on behalf of Hamas over the past 2.5 months since the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh at the end of July.
President Biden has spoken about a possible path to peace with the death of Yahya Sinwar. Do you see it in that way, or is it really dependent upon who succeeds him?
I think President Biden has just damaged his credibility as the president of the superpower in the world. He has spoken a lot lately over the past year about the two-state solution, about the ceasefire, about the need for the entry of humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip. But at the end of the day, it doesn't seem to me that any decision that has to do with a ceasefire or with a prisoner exchange deal with the hostages has to do with President Biden. This decision belongs to Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and his right-wing cabinet. At the end of the day, it will be Netanyahu who will decide to have a ceasefire, to put an end to this destruction and war in Gaza, and to reach a prisoner deal with Hamas.
That was Mekayma Abu Sadr, a former professor of political science at Al-Azhar University in Gaza. Well, the killing of the Hamas leader has for the moment brought no respite for Palestinians in Gaza as Israeli airstrikes and shelling continue unabated in the territory. Large swathes of northern Gaza remain under siege by Israeli forces, with road closures preventing the delivery of supplies to the area. Despite warnings from the United States, the failure to end the blockade could trigger a reduction in arms deliveries to Israel. Amichai Chakli is a minister in the Israeli government.
It is the northern part of Gaza. We are speaking about the region of Jabalia, Bet Lahia, Bet Hanun. We've created a blockade with our forces. We allowed the civilian population to escape into the safe zone, and we prevented supply to enter the blockade region, which was a very specific region where Hamas was trying to recover its administration and its military capabilities. This practice of blockade is legal according to the international law. And despite the fact that it is legal, and this is a well-known and well-relevant practice to use in a war against terror organization, let's say there was a criticism from the current government in America, and we can have disagreement, but still we have a lot of collaborations, and I think we can handle this, let's say, crisis and to move on.
That was Israeli government minister Amichai Chikli. And Georgios Petropoulos is the head of the UN's Office for Humanitarian Assistance, based in Rafah in southern Gaza. What is he hearing from the north, and in particular Jabalia?
We can't hit that alarm bell hard enough about how dire and dangerous the situation for civilians there is. families that are in North Gaza, especially the ones in Jabalia camp, which is surrounded by Israeli forces, are trying to survive in what can only be described as atrocious conditions under a very heavy bombardment. Today, I understand from UNRWA, they've confirmed that one of its schools in the north was attacked. This was yesterday. There were many people sheltering there, scores, including children. Just today, we've submitted an urgent request to the Israelis for their assistance to facilitate, to coordinate, to allow, let's say, the evacuation of 3 dozen people from 2 buildings that are trapped under rubble. These are people who are just outside Jabalia camp.
So is northern Gaza besieged? Can aid agencies get in?
Northern Gaza consists of 2 governorates, Gaza Governorate and North Gaza. North Gaza is under almost entire evacuation orders. About 420,000 people live north of the Wadi still. In Jabalia city, since the last 3 days when we've seen trucks come back into northern Gaza from the crossings, you know, the World Food Programme only received enough supplies for about 10,000 families, maybe 50,000 people. And that's going to last them maybe a week. So there has to be a steady supply and not just flour. People are out of fuel. There's no cooking gas. There's no wood. They're out of clean water. And we have completely run out of all shelter material for people who have to leave their homes with fighting, sometimes overnight with just their clothes on their back. In the North Gaza Governorate, although there are some hospitals still functioning barely, the health system has all but collapsed. So in Jabalia camp, which is under siege, whatever they have is what they had on October 1st.
So just to clarify, for the past nearly 3 weeks, you and others have been unable to make any deliveries of aid to the far north of Gaza.
So this started on October 1st. And after that, the only deliveries of aid that we have had to the North Gaza Governorate are fuel to the Kamal Adwan Hospital and an evacuation of patients on October 12th, and only supplies and fuel to Gaza City, so south of where the fighting is. So you are correct to say that we haven't been able to make deliveries up north there. The only way we get to the north is to the crossings to do transshipment, but then all of those supplies are brought to Gaza City.
And do you actually face military challenges when you try to go to the far north with your aid convoys and are told, sorry, you can't go any further?
So in order to access several places in the north, there's going to be 2 options. The first is that you're either getting too close to fighting and you have to coordinate with the Israeli forces, or you physically have to go through their lines or so proximate that you're basically next to their tanks and soldiers. At that point, we do have a couple of points where we have to stop. It's like a checkpoint, be recognized and processed through. On October 12th, when we evacuated Kamal Adwan of 18 patients with the World Health Organization and other colleagues from the UN and NGOs, including the Red Crescent, 2 Palestinian colleagues, one from the UN and one from the Red Crescent, were stripped. And one of them was handcuffed, blindfolded, and both were for about an hour harassed and intimidated by the Israeli ground forces before we could negotiate taking them back, putting them on the convoy and continuing on our way. This is not the first time this happens. It's almost a daily occurrence, intimidation, harassment, and seemingly active pushback of the attempts that humanitarians make to reach people in very dire straits in northern Gaza.
Following the killing of Yahya Sinwar, a number of Western governments have talked about a turning point. President Biden himself has spoken about a path to peace. How do you see it? Do you see the logjam, your inability to get aid into the north, being relieved in any kind of way?
No, I still see children dying on the floor of hospitals for lack of a hospital bed. I still see people with shocking injuries from explosions not being able to have a CT scan or MRI because not a single one of those machines exists still. Dialysis patients dying because there's no fuel allowed to get to hospitals. We don't see a path to peace from where we are here in Gaza.
That was Georgios Petropoulos, the head of the UN's Office for Humanitarian Assistance, or OCHA, based in Rafah in southern Gaza. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. Coming up very shortly, the American rapper P. Diddy, facing charges of rape and assault, which he denies, was renowned for throwing elaborate parties. We'll hear from his former publicist.
He was just figuring out that how he could get the most attention was to become this party king of New York. He knew that parties is something that everybody wants, and he's good at it. People were killing themselves to get in. I used to get phone calls from publicists, from A-list celebrities begging to get tickets.
The latest headlines from the BBC newsroom. The United States, Britain and Germany say the killing of the Hamas leader by Israel offers a chance to end the war in Gaza. But a UN spokesman told the BBC he saw no path to peace. And a massive power failure in Cuba has led to the collapse of the electricity grid across the entire country. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. It was only yesterday that the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni addressed a meeting of European countries at which she presented an innovative plan to reduce migration. It involves, she said, sending would-be migrants to Italy to Albania instead for processing their asylum claims. The first group were sent to Albania on Monday after being picked up in the Mediterranean. But today an Italian court has ruled against the plan. I heard more from the BBC's Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay.
The background to all of this is Giorgia Meloni wanting to be seen to be doing something to tackle the issue of irregular migration. She's heading a right-wing government, which said they would sort out this issue, and having this offshored for some asylum seekers in Albania was one way of addressing this. Now, critics had said this was a rather performative and expensive way of addressing this. It was costing officially 670 million euros to set up these two asylum processing centres in Albania, which would be staffed by Italian officials who had to be shuttled to and from and also accommodated. So this was all costing a lot of money, and it was looking like quite a performative process in the first place. But Giorgia Meloni was trying to present this as being a potential solution for other European countries as well.
So what has the Italian court said? Why can this not go ahead?
Well, it has said quite bluntly, you can't do this. And you can't do this because the European Court of Justice has ruled you can't willy-nilly declare a country safe just because you'd like to have people from those countries who are applying for asylum in Italy offshore to Albania. And in the instance that we've got of the first arrivals at these Italian processing centres in Albania, the people concerned, 16 of them, were from Egypt and Bangladesh. There are parts of those countries which are not considered safe under various international criteria.
So where does the Italian government go from here?
The Italian government probably has to appeal because it's lost a lot of face in this. To be frank, this was a problem that people could see coming. The European Court of Justice made its ruling earlier this month on October the 4th. And a lot of people were wondering whether some of these safe countries that Italy had declared that they would use the Albanian centres for, they were wondering whether this would fall foul of that European court ruling. This is now the case. So, of course, you've got to imagine the government will appeal because they've sunk an awful lot of money, but more importantly, an awful lot of political capital into this and diplomatic capital as well, because Giorgia Meloni was basking in the admiration of certain European leaders and the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, who thought it was a very jolly idea for other EU countries to follow.
As you say, not just a setback for Giorgia Meloni's government, but potentially for the governments of other European countries as well, who were closely watching to see how this model worked out.
Well, indeed, if they fancied it as a way of sorting out what they deemed to be problems with irregular migration, it's now going to give them serious pause for thought. If you're looking at it from the point of view of human rights organisations, they're delighted with the verdict, and they're saying that the rule of law has been upheld by both the courts in Italy and the European Court. I suppose another question that one should ask is, bearing in mind that the European Union has come up with different arrangements for tackling the issue of irregular migration and ensuring that it's not just one or two countries that bear the brunt, do you actually need to have such schemes in place at all? Is there not capacity and capability in these EU member states to deal with that? Or are they just more interested in performative politics as they see right-wing parties getting more support?
That was the BBC's Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay. There have been a series of new sexual assault allegations against the former hip-hop star P. Diddy, with seven new lawsuits filed this week in New York and California. The rapper, whose real name is Sean Combs, is accused of having drugged, raped and assaulted women and men over more than a decade during the peak of his fame. He denies all the allegations. He was known for throwing elaborate parties in New York, Los Angeles and London. Now his former publicist has spoken exclusively to the BBC's Emma Vardy about the power held by the former music star.
A ticket to one of P. Diddy's parties was the hottest invite in town.
This is a legendary white party. It's the real white party. Make some noise if you've been here before.
It was an A-list spectacle. Guests included Jay-Z, Beyonce and Usher. There was an all-white dress code, circus performers, dancing and no shortage of champagne.
He put on a show. He was the ring master in this circus that he created.
That's Rob Shooter, Diddy's former publicist.
He was just starting, he was just figuring out that how he could get the most attention was to become this party king of New York. He knew that parties is something that everybody wants, and he's good at it. People were killing themselves to get in. I used to get phone calls from publicists, from A-list celebrities begging to get tickets.
But some of Diddy's parties are now alleged to have had a different side. In recordings from the parties obtained by the BBC, the rapper even hinted at it himself.
And to all the kids, have like an hour left, because after that, y'all got to go. It's a wrap for y'all, because this thing turns into something that when y'all get older, y'all don't want to come to, okay?
More than once. Here he was on a well-known US talk show.
What do you do to make just an amazing killer party?
Women.
Beautiful women.
Yeah.
We need alcohol. You need the ladies, you need the booze.
Right.
You need locks on the doors. Okay, this is sounding kind of dangerous now.
It's a little kinky, but
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Though Rob says he never saw anything illegal, he did see the power that Diddy could command.
I've seen people throw themselves at Diddy. They want his attention. I've been in clubs with Diddy at 1 in the morning, and girls and guys would certainly want to be part of his world.
The indictment alleges that Combs abused and exploited women and other people for years.
In recent months, allegations have continued to mount. Sean Combs has been charged with criminal offences, including sex trafficking and transportation for prostitution, and drugging and raping alleged victims. There's also been more than a dozen civil suits accusing the star of sexual assaults and rape, with lawyers saying there'll be more to come. We're on the street here in Beverly Hills where P. Diddy lived, and some of the parties happened at this mansion. Now, we've gone door to door trying to speak to some of his neighbours, but of course, privacy is very valued here. All the mansions are hiding behind high fences and high gates, so no one was keen to chat openly. But one neighbour told us this, and her words have been voiced by an actor.
For 6 or 7 years, it was just parties, parties and parties. We saw girls coming out and sitting down on the street. They didn't know where they were. Their underwear was showing and they were just lost. I was worried about them.
Police records obtained by the BBC show that officers were dispatched more than a dozen times to this property alone.
He's a predator.
What do you have to say about your son's allegations?
The last time Sean Combs was seen in public was at a courthouse in New York, where he was led out in a creased prison uniform. The criminal case is being watched closely by lawyers representing alleged victims who filed their own lawsuits.
It's definitely what we call a reckoning.
Gloria Allred is a prominent women's rights lawyer who's been an advocate for many victims in similar cases.
There are many alleged victims who have kept silent for many, many years, either because they were intimidated or were threatened, and they may feel more confidence as this case progresses. So I would say we're at the beginning, essentially, and not at all anywhere near the end.
Sean Combs is now awaiting trial at a prison in Brooklyn, just a short drive from the New York parties he once presided over. His lawyer says he emphatically and categorically denies all allegations and says they are false and defamatory. He's set to stand trial in May next year.
The BBC's Emma Vardy with that report. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall. This is NewsHour. Do stay with us. A lot more to come in the next 30 minutes.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
You're with NewsHour. And the British Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, is on an official visit to China in a bid to improve relations. It's the first visit by a UK minister since the Labour Party took office in July. Under the previous government, the UK and China clashed in recent years over human rights, and China sanctioned some British politicians. Mr. Lammy has described his meeting with his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi, as constructive. Ellen Milligan is the UK political correspondent of Bloomberg. Is Mr. Lammy making a conscious effort to reset relations with China?
Yes, exactly. David Lammy is on a two-day visit. He had a bilateral meeting with his counterpart, Wang Yi, in Beijing today, and tomorrow he heads to Shanghai to meet British business leaders. And the UK's intention is, as you say, to revive high-level communications and economic cooperation with China. I think the new Labour government believes that the Conservatives flip-flopped on its China policy, you know, from the golden era under David Cameron, where him and President Xi shared pints in a pub in the Cotswolds, to a full freezing of communications in the aftermath of China's brutal implementation of its national security laws in Hong Kong around the turn of the decade. So it wants to forge what it describes as a consistent long-term approach.
And this new pragmatic approach, does it rule out talking about human rights abuses in China?
Actually, in the readout that followed the meeting from the UK, Lammy, according to that readout, urged Wang Yi to investigate and prevent Chinese companies from supplying Russia's military operation in Ukraine, for example, big concern for allies, and also raised concerns about human rights in Xinjiang, in Hong Kong, as I said, and call for the release of British national Jimmy Lai. But I will say that in the readout, what was absent was the word Taiwan. And this week we've seen China order its second major military drill around the Taiwan Strait since its new president took office in May. So I was surprised to not see that. And actually, if you read the Chinese readout, clearly there were some quite tense conversations over this, because China, after the meeting, called Taiwan and Hong Kong internal affairs and urged for international partners not to, in their words, interfere with those.
I mean, very briefly, I suppose it would be too cynical to say that this is all about money, but this new Labour government is very keen, is it not, on investment as an engine of growth.
Yeah, and they identified some areas where they'd like to cooperate on. So green energy, for example, science, health. It's not clear to me yet whether that would mean they would accept Chinese investment in critical infrastructure. For example, the last government unpicked an investment in a chip manufacturer in the UK. And actually, Bloomberg reported this week that new Labour ministers were informed entering government of widespread and likely successful efforts by Chinese state actors to access and compromise its critical infrastructure networks. And it's not quite clear where they stand on that yet.
That was Ellen Milligan, UK political correspondent at Bloomberg. You're listening to NewsHour, coming to you live from the BBC in London. I'm Julian Marshall. The images of the death of Yahya Sinwar and the moments before it, apparently recorded by an Israeli drone, show a man with a badly wounded right arm sitting in an armchair in a racked building in Rafah. It appears that a short while later a shell, possibly from a nearby Israeli tank, was fired into the building. Sinwar was dead. Well, speaking on a brief visit to Germany, President Biden hailed the death of the Hamas leader as a good day for the world, and that he had a lot of blood on his hands. As for the woman who wants to succeed him in the White House, the vice president and Democratic nominee, Kamala Harris, she said this was now an opportunity for the conflict to come to an end.
This moment gives us an opportunity to finally end the war in Gaza. And it must end such that Israel is secure, the hostages are released, the suffering in Gaza ends, and the Palestinian people can realize their right to dignity, security, freedom, and self-determination. And it is time for the day after to begin without Hamas in power.
Well, my colleague Tim Franks has been speaking to Frank Lowenstein, the former U.S. Special Envoy for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations at the end of the Obama administration. What does he think the impact of Yahya Sinwar's death will be?
I think it's certainly the hope on the U.S. end that it will open up new possibilities to return to ceasefire negotiations and hopefully end the war. I think as of right now, though, we're almost headed in the opposite direction. The Hamas came out with a statement this morning saying they were going to continue with Sinwar's positions with respect to the ceasefire, which is a full Israeli withdrawal and a permanent end to the war, which the Israelis have never been willing to accept. And on the Israeli side, you have Netanyahu, who said this is the beginning of the end of the war, that the war will continue. So I think the United States is going to try to leverage this moment as much as we possibly can. But so far, it looks like the parties on the ground are continuing down the path they've been on for the last 6 months or so.
And interesting to hear you use the word leverage, because around the region, that will raise a fairly bitter smile on a lot of people's faces, because U.S. leverage has been, it seems, pretty much non-existent.
Yeah, that's fair to a point. We're trying to change that dynamic a little bit. The Secretary Blinken and Austin sent a letter to the Israelis last week saying if they don't change their posture with respect to humanitarian assistance in Gaza, they will be looking at a cutoff of U.S. weapons deliveries. Whether we follow through on that or not remains to be seen, but it does suggest that we're more willing to take tough steps with the Israelis than we have been in the past.
Yeah, we had Amichai Chikli, a minister in the Israeli government, on the program earlier. I raised that point with him, and he said, you know, we've had these disagreements before with the U.S. administration. We can handle this crisis and move on. He seemed signally unmoved by this idea that they had 30 days to improve the humanitarian situation in northern Gaza.
Yeah, I think that their view is probably that we won't wind up enforcing that in 30 days. But we're trying to be aligned with the Israelis as much as possible these days, mainly because of Iran. I think we've had major disagreements over Gaza and to some extent Lebanon, but we really need to be aligned with them on Iran because they need us. They need us to help protect Israel against any Iranian response. They may need us to support their efforts if they're doing long-range bombing missions and that kind of thing.
Isn't the truth, though, that you also need to be aligned with Israel because of the U.S. presidential election calendar? I mean, there is no prospect, surely, of the Biden administration doing anything significant before the beginning of November.
Yeah, I know. You're exactly right. And that was why the letter from Blinken gave the Israelis 30 days to comply, because that way we don't have to make a decision on that before the election. At the same time, it gave Harris an opportunity to say to Arab American voters, we're doing everything we can to get humanitarian assistance and we care about the plight of the Palestinian people. So there's a bit of an effort to split the difference politically there by the Biden folks.
That was Frank Lowenstein, a former U.S. Special Envoy for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. A social media trend known as Yamibaito, or dark part-time jobs, has been causing concern in Japan. A string of robberies and scams have been linked to the phenomenon, which involves people being recruited for criminal jobs via social media. Dan Hardoon has been looking into it for BBC Trending.
How can applying for a part-time job on social media end up with you going to prison? That's what happened to Hiroshi, whose name we've changed to protect his identity. In 2020, Hiroshi quit his job due to severe depression. Desperate for work, he came across a post on X, formerly Twitter, offering what was vaguely described as a job using the internet, paying the equivalent of $200 a day.
I got in touch and they replied to me on Twitter's DM function and told me to switch the conversation over to Telegram. About a day later, they asked me to send my ID. They also asked me for emergency contact information, so I gave them my parents' details.
Initially, Hiroshi was told to print out a document at a local convenience store. But when it turned out to be a fake police ID with his photo on it, he became suspicious and told the recruiter he no longer wanted the job.
I called them and said I don't want to go through with it. They started threatening me, saying they know where I live. They said, "We are going to set fire to your house or throw you in the ocean." I just remember feeling very scared.
Hiroshi is one of many people in Japan who've been sucked into an online phenomenon known as Yamibaito. They're dark part-time jobs where ordinary people are recruited for criminal activities using social media. The job postings most commonly appear on platforms like X as well as Line, a Japanese messenger app. They use hashtags like side job or high-paying part-time job. Hiroshi told us he felt pressured into doing this work. He was involved in 5 scams targeting elderly people for their bank cards and was eventually jailed for 3 years for fraud. He says he now bitterly regrets what he did.
What sticks with me is that all the elderly victims really believed that these scam stories were true. I felt even more guilty looking at them in that state.
If you felt so guilty, why didn't you decide to just stop?
Every time I told them I wanted to stop, they started threatening me all over again.
Yamibaito covers a wide range of crimes, including drug trafficking, money laundering, and theft. In May 2023, a high-profile robbery at a luxury watch store in Tokyo's Ginza district brought the issue to national attention when it emerged that one of the suspects had apparently been recruited on social media. Since then, Japanese police have been cracking down, but BBC Trending has explored evidence that recruiters are still operating online. My colleague, Ryuzo Tsutsui, set up an anonymous account on X following BBC guidelines and contacted some of those accounts tweeting Yamibaito-style posts.
One got back to me. He said, "As a job, this is very easy. You just need to carry some stuff. If you can stay in contact and do as we say, there's a low risk of getting pakurareru, which means cuffed." So I asked him, "Is there a risk of getting arrested?" And he said, and I quote, "What do you think a courier job is? This is not Kuroneko Yamato," which is a Japanese courier service. Obviously, I didn't agree to do anything illegal for them.
We can't say for certain that this courier job is illegal, but the emphasis on not getting caught and the overall communication pattern closely mirrors Yamibaito. Of course, this isn't unique to Japan. Side hustles are popular all over the world, and social media has made it far easier for criminal recruiters to draw people in. For now, the best advice is to be wary of any online job posting promising unusually high pay. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Dan Hardoon reporting, and you can hear the full trending documentary, Yamibaito, Inside Japan's Dark Part-Time Jobs, now on BBC Sounds. North Korea is known to be supplying Russia with military support for the war in Ukraine, but is it also now supplying troops? South Korea says it is. The country's spy agency says the Russian Navy has transported hundreds of members of North Korean special forces to Russia's Far East. Ukraine's President Zelensky has amplified the South Korean spy agency claim, saying some 15,000 North Korean troops could be deployed, while Ukraine's foreign minister has called for a strong and immediate reaction from the country's allies. Nicole Wolkoff is a Russia analyst with the Institute for the Study in War in Washington. So what have they been picking up?
South Korean intelligence services, as well as Ukrainian intelligence services, have reported that North Korean troops are moving to Russia for deployment in Ukraine.
And how many North Korean troops are we talking about here?
So we've observed various different numbers from different sources in both the Ukrainian side and the South Korean side, anywhere between 1,500, 3,000 to more.
But I understand that there have been reports of North Korean soldiers sighted in Ukraine already?
Yes. So both unspecified U.S. military and intelligence officials, as well as the South Korean National Intelligence Service, have stated that likely North Korean engineers and military observers are operating in occupied Ukraine and Russia to help build and operate the North Korean-provided ballistic missiles that North Korea provided to the Russian military.
Do you see them, though, as taking on any combat duties? I mean, what do North Korean special forces, for instance, offer in this conflict that are not offered by Russian forces?
So today, the South Korean National Intelligence Service did state that about 1,500 North Korean special forces were deployed to eastern Russia and that more are expected soon. We assess that Russia likely intends to deploy these North Korean forces to Kursk Oblast for rear and defensive operations, not to participate in combat operations. But the Russian military is doing this in order to free up Russian forces to combat operations in Ukraine.
So the special forces, therefore, professional soldiers rather than conscripts.
Yes, although ISW cannot independently confirm what type of forces this is. This is just the report from the South Korean intelligence services.
The reasons that these North Korean troops might be deployed in Kursk, obviously to relieve Russian soldiers serving there to go and fight on other fronts, but presumably possibly to make up for a lack of manpower within Russia itself.
I think this more speaks to the Kremlin's interest in continuing its crypto mobilization efforts and pursuing alternative force generation efforts instead of having to declare partial or general mobilization. So prioritizing combat operations on the front line in Ukraine with Russian forces. And so this is a way to continue defensive operations in Kursk, but prioritize the front line.
And the two countries do have some sort of defense pact under which presumably this transfer of military personnel would be permitted?
Yes. So in June of this year, Russia and North Korea signed a comprehensive strategic partnership agreement, which has a mutual defense provision. So this would be the legal justification for the deployment of North Korean soldiers to Russia and to participate in any sort of Russian operations in and around Ukraine.
That was Russia analyst Nikol Volkov. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. Cuba is experiencing a nationwide blackout from one end of the island to the other after one of its major power stations came offline. The problem has left millions of Cubans without electricity or relying on their own generators for power. Let's speak to the BBC's Cuba correspondent, Will Grant. And Will, what's gone wrong?
Well, a whole series of things. This hasn't just happened overnight. To be perfectly honest, over recent months, the situation has been deteriorating significantly, particularly in the provinces, some of whom have been dealing with days where they might have 18, even 20 hours of no power. By and large, the government tries to make sure that it directs what it can of its domestic production of electricity to the capital, Havana, to make sure the lights are kept on in the capital. But really what appears to have happened today on Friday is that even that now has been knocked out. Things quite quickly went from bad to worse when the government said that state workers were to stay home, that schools and universities wouldn't be opening, that businesses should shutter in a sort of an attempt to stave off the problem. But then quickly after that announced an electricity emergency, saying that Antonio Guterres, one of the most important power plants in the country, was as good as offline, and that's 10 million Cubans without power.
And did the government say what it was doing in order to fix the problem?
As you can imagine, they're saying they're working round the clock. That came from the president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, on the social media site X, saying they wouldn't rest until electricity is restored. The problem is there was no time frame put on that, and the truth of the matter is they simply don't know how long it will take. It could be a few hours, it could be longer. I think there's nervousness among the Cuban government about what that could lead to, because there has been social unrest in the recent past, particularly July 2021, sparked by a lack of power, because, of course, it's not just the lack of power. That means fridges are off, freezers are off, which means very valuable foodstuffs, which are, of course, hard to come by in Cuba, are rotting in the fridges. That means that, air conditioning and fans are off, which means mosquitoes, things like that. It makes life extremely uncomfortable for people. Water might not be pumped to people's buildings. So all of that is, of course, a worry to the Cuban government. But even if they get it back online, that doesn't mean they'll be dealing with some of the underpinning problems.
And has the government found anyone to blame?
Well, as you can imagine, again, their first port of call is to blame the United States and the U.S. economic embargo. And to an extent, that is at play here. If you can't get replacement parts for your energy infrastructure, of course, that is part of the issue. But the other part of the issue is that simply the two main energy production plants aren't fit for purpose anymore. They can't meet domestic demand. And Venezuela, socialist ally to Cuba for many years, simply isn't sending the same amounts that it did first under Hugo Chavez at the turn of the century, and even last year, it's about half the amount that was sent in oil shipments just a year ago from Venezuela.
Will, many thanks. That was our Cuba correspondent, Will Grant. Overcoming a cocaine addiction is all about reducing cravings. Other chemicals can help do that, but researchers are also looking at ways of lessening the cues or triggers for addicts which remind them of the pleasurable effects of cocaine, such as being alone in an apartment or at a party with friends. A new project here in the UK involves the use of virtual reality. So how does the treatment work? Paolo De Luca is Professor of Addiction Research at King's College in London and the lead researcher on the project.
The treatment for cocaine dependence currently relies heavily on psychological interventions, also known as talking therapies like CBT. And what happens at the moment is that there's a very poor engagement and high rates of relapse. And what we are trying to do with this study is to address the craving experience. So cue exposure treatment is a therapeutic approach that involves exposing someone to an object or situations that make them want to take any substance, but in this instance, cocaine, without obviously letting them actually do it. And this repeated exposure to these situations reduces or even extinguishes this automatic response or craving.
So you encourage your subjects to put on a VR headset and then you conjure up perhaps a party scene for them.
Yes. We are currently working on our apartment scenario as well as a party or a pub scenarios. And the decision on using these environments will be based on the patient's preferences. So in that sense, the intervention will be even more personalized to the actual situations that they find more triggering.
So when the subject is in this virtual pub, this virtual party, do you speak to them, or is it simply the repetition of this imagery that reduces the craving?
Two things there. One is how engaging the environment can be, and we are planning to make the environments as engaging as possible. It will include conversations with other virtual agents within the scenario, and that will increase the immersive experience they are witnessing in virtual reality. But how cue exposure works is that by exposing people to these situations frequently, their craving is lower than before the intervention was delivered.
I don't quite understand how this is different from the person going into a pub again and again and again. How does the virtual experience differ?
Well, the difference is essentially that they are exposed to craving situations. They are practicing coping skills in a safe therapeutic setting. And they are also not using cocaine in response to the craving situation. So they are able to reduce or even extinguish this automatic response they have learned by using cocaine in their own environment.
And you know that this potentially could work, as I understand it, because virtual reality has been tried with alcoholics?
Yes, conventional acute exposure treatment has been used successfully with people with alcohol dependence and also with other mental health conditions. So we know that it works. But the evidence for cocaine is emerging, and this would be one of the first studies that will provide further evidence that it can be implemented, but also is an acceptable and feasible approach for treating cocaine dependence.
Paolo De Luca, Professor of Addiction Research at King's College in London, bringing to an end this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.